Session number 12786.
Major Ivory Uto.
Yes, as we were approaching the beach, we could see that that some enemy fire was coming back at the craft approaching the beach. We were unscathed, and we had, but I saw one or two neighbouring craft hit by shells or mortar bombs. We got to the beach. And we were very heavily laden, including quite a lot of stores which we were intending to leave on the beach, which we did. These were spare mortar bombs for 3-inch mortars and that sort of thing. The beach was quite wide at this point. It was about 300 metres from the point where we touched down to the far side of the beach, where there were sand dunes, and we got across there more or less unscathed, but when we got to the dunes at the far side of the beach, we found that at that moment there was a minefield, which we knew was there, but we had hoped that it would have been breached by armored flail vehicles. When we arrived, it hadn't been breached at all. I had to decide whether we were going to try and make our way through the minefield or go up or down the beach. And we'd always been trained, get off the beach. I decided that, but that time there was a lot of machine gun fire coming down the beach. It was very unhealthy. I lost two of my platoon killed, and I'm not sure whether they were killed actually crossing the beach or when we were sheltering, so to speak, in the dunes on the far side of the beach. But we were very lucky, because when I just made my mind up, we had to go through that minefield, which I didn't like one little bit. A flail tank appeared on our left, about 50 yards to our left, and began to flail through the minefield, and got through to the far side. Now, this was actually in the area of the first Dorsets on our left, but I wasn't going to fuss about that. We went for that breach, and we got through it. And then when we got through it on the far side, then of course we swung right to our original objective. It was clear afterwards, when we had time to look, when I had time to look at my map, that we landed about, I'm not sure, but 200 or 300 meters to the left or to the east of the area where it had been intended that we should. And in the event, that proved very fortunate, because the further to the west you were, the more unhealthy it was. The main trouble was coming from an enemy strong point at Lahamal. And as I say, those who landed closest to Lahamal got the worst of it. And so we were, in a sense, although you might say it was unfortunate that we were landed in the wrong place, in actual fact, in the event, it was very fortunate, because it enabled us to get off the beach. And then, of course, we could swing right and make for our allotted objective. We encountered two small enemy positions on the way towards Lahamal. They there was a bit of firing at each of them, but in fact, we didn't have too much resistance from them. And we took a few prisoners there and pressed on towards Le Hamel. Now, that was that strong point that Le Hamel really held up most of the, not most of, a large part of the battalion for some hours. But it finally, because it was a proper strong point, but finally it was reduced by petards fired from these armoured vehicles, Royal Engineers, which had got ashore. We had hoped, of course, they were going to get ashore earlier, but they had got ashore, and they were very useful. They did a very good job. And with covering their fire, with covered by their fire, we got into Le Hamel and subdued it.
Were you there when those prisoners were taken?
Oh, yes, I was there. Yeah.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, in one particular instance, of course, two or three of them came out of their trenches and put their hands up, and so we took them. And then when we got close to this position, of course, we realised there were a number more down below, under cover in dugouts with overhead cover, and we threatened to throw grenades down, and they all came out with their hands up, and that was a bit satisfying, of course.
Can you take it on a bit further now, please?
Well, what we had been, we had our allotted areas in which we were due to take up defensive positions to protect the beachhead which we'd gained. One of our companies was due to attack a gun position on our extreme right, and they did that, and they were very successful there. And then we pressed on through Arromanches. We went through Arromanches, and there wasn't. I think most of the Germans who had been in there had gone. We pressed on beyond Arromanches to our allotted areas, and by the evening, we had arrived in the approximate area where we were supposed to form this position, because form this defensive ring around the beachhead. There had to be a certain amount of reorganisation because the battalion had suffered quite a lot of casualties. I think the final figure was, for killed and wounded, was just under 200. And companies and platoons were not altogether at full strength. And so there had to be a certain amount of reorganisation or adjustment of the original plans. We got to, my platoon was allotted a position where we were on the outskirts, amongst quite nice villas on the outskirts of Arromanches. And we were instructed to dig in there, and which we proceeded to do. I had a little difficulty there, which surprised me, because I was busy digging myself when I heard when from one of the section positions which I'd assigned, I heard voices raised in argument, and I heard a female voice saying, I demand to speak to the officer in charge. And I was very surprised to hear this, so I went over to see what was going on, and I found there a lady who declared she was English, and I'm sure she was. And she pointed an accusing finger at me and said, "Your men are digging up my flower beds and making a whole mess of the place, and it's quite unnecessary. And I demand that they stop." And I was a bit put out by this, but I thought back to these stories we'd heard in the German invasion of the Low Countries in 1940, when they were said to have employed paratroop saboteurs dressed as nuns. And I wonder for the moment whether this was one of those, but quite obviously she wasn't. But she was very smartly dressed and very insistent. I thought, well, I must put a stop to this. So I told her very curtly that I was not going to have any of this nonsense. And I asked her if her house had a cellar, and she said it had. So I said to her, "Well, if you don't want to be shot, go down there and stay there until I tell you you can come out." She was very incensed at this, but off she went back down to her cellar, and that was the last I saw of her. And we were then, very shortly after that, we were obliged to realign our defensive positions, and I had to take my platoon off from the area where they'd been digging into to another one a few hundred yards away and start digging a defensive position there, which we did. And we got that position organized during the night, and we had been, of course, we'd been warned to expect, and indeed it was common sense to expect, an enemy counterattack. But in fact, the night passed quite peacefully, and we had no trouble at all. And the lady back in the cellar, well, I forgot to tell her to come out. Whether she's still there or not, I don't know.
Was she older than you?
I would put her in her early 40s, yes, she was.
Nearly old enough to be your mother, then?
Possibly.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, on the 7th of June, we were ordered to patrol certain woods nearby, just to flush out any enemy that might still be hanging around. We didn't find any. And we were then, at the end of the 7th, we were concentrated, the battalion was concentrated in a bivouac area. And we met our new commanding officer, our commanding officer, Colonel Nelson Smith, for D-Day, had been wounded on the beach and evacuated. And a new commanding officer was appointed from a pool of commanding officers. His name was Colonel Howie, and I met him for the first time on the 7th. We weren't by that time, of course. Other forces had passed through. Other divisions, in fact, had passed through, and we were at that stage in reserve. It wasn't until, I think, about the 9th or 10th that we were pushed forward again to embark upon enlarging the bridgehead.
Just before we go on to that, can I ask you what you felt about the accomplishment of D-Day itself as far as you were concerned? Had it been easier or more difficult than you expected?
I think, on the whole, slightly more difficult. We'd had quite a lot of casualties, and a lot of the supporting fire that we had expected hadn't materialised. But nevertheless, I personally never expected it to be a walkover, and I had hoped that we would do it with fewer casualties. We'd had quite a lot, and to that extent, it was a disappointment. But nevertheless, we'd achieve what we set out to do. And we'd got all our objectives, so that was a plus.
Had there been anything which had taken you by surprise about the D-Day landings and the enemy opposition? Or had it been more or less as you'd expected?
More or less as I expected. And as I've said, the failure of the of a good deal of our supporting fire was a disappointment, and I had expected the enemy to resist strongly, and they did.
What did you feel about the morale and performance of your own troops in your platoon?
I was quite happy with that. It was good. I think in the case of my own platoon, we had been very fortunate in the sense that that we'd had two chaps killed, and that was all.
Did most of them come from Hampshire?
Most, not all, by a long chalk, but I can't be sure of this, but I would say probably of the 30 men, perhaps 15 to 20 came from Hampshire or nearby.
Now, you said that on the 9th and 10th you were engaged in trying to enlarge the bridgehead. What did that involve for you personally?
Well, that involved attacking a position, an enemy position, near a place called Bernier Bocage. That was not successful at that stage.
What was it called?
Bernier Bocage.
How do you spell it?
B-E-R-N-I-E, Grav, R-E-S, hyphen, B-O-C-A-G-E. We were in the Bocage then by then, and that, of course, was something we were to experience for some weeks to come. It's very, very close country, lots of hedges and ditches, very small fields, very short fields of fire, ideal for defence. And this was our problem, of course. It was a problem that really the whole of the force experienced. And it wasn't really until we got clear of the Bocage in August that life became easier.
What do you remember happening on the 9th and 10th, personally?
By that time, I was commanding a company. And
C Company?
Yes. And the battalion was formed up for an attack, which was really on the axis of a road running through Bernier Bocage onto another place called La Sinodia. And that attack never really got going. And in a sense, I with my company, we were almost spectators because we were in a defense. We got in a defensive position, and my orders were that as the advance moved off, I was to fall in behind, so to speak, my company, and act as a reserve company to deal with any problems which might arise. In actual fact, the attack never got going. It only advanced 100 yards or so before it came to a grinding halt. And so we remained in our defensive position, and really, in a sense, we sat tight because there was nothing else for us to do. We weren't committed to try and deal with the enemy, which were holding up the leading companies, because it was for the CO to decide. He never actually ordered us forward, and I think he was right there, because it was obviously that the opposition was much stiffer than had been expected. And so we had to do it again, try again a couple of days, or one or two days later. And this time we were successful. We got to this, we succeeded in attacking and capturing this road junction at the little village called La Sinodia.
Now, can I ask you about a question in general about Normandy? How much contact did you have with Norman civilians and what their attitude was to D-Day and the liberation?
We didn't have much contact with Norman civilians at that time, because in the areas where we were in contact most of the time, really up to the end of July, the civilians had fled, and it was very rare to see any of them in our forward areas. I think that from what I've heard, heard said from those who are a little bit more in the rear than we were, that the Norman civilians regarded us as a mixed blessing. But post-war, I've been back there, and of course they're extremely friendly, and they still express their gratitude for being liberated. We did encounter a few civilians in the, what you might call the breakout period in August. And I remember that my company, we set up a defensive position which was really based on a farm where the farmers were still, the farmer and his family were still there. And they were very friendly and produced all sorts of food and drink and that sort of thing. But that was an isolated instance. And to sum up, I think that they were the few that I saw were friendly and helpful, but we didn't see very many because, as I say, they had fled, and I don't blame them.
Again, a general question about Normandy. What did you feel about the caliber of the German opposition then?
The German opposition, I think, was well trained and good, but this I think may have varied with one formation to another. We were in opposition most of the time to Panzer Lehr, who were a full strength division. I think mainly made up of training organizations which in peaceful circumstances trained their armored forces, and they were very good. There were other. At one stage, we were opposite another German division called 276th Division, and they were reputedly not such a high caliber. They were said to contain quite a proportion of Polish conscripts. And indeed, at one stage, when we were in a defensive position near a place called Hotto, I suppose some organization designed to some organization on our side designed to encourage disaffection amongst the enemy, they came forward and arranged that they were going to set up loudspeakers in our forward areas to broadcast in Polish to the Poles and to induce them to surrender. They did their broadcast, and we expected a fiery response. And we made sure that we'd all got our slit trenches ready to hand when this broadcast took place. But absolutely nothing happened. There was no counterfire, and no Poles came over to surrender. So,
so it was a damp squib.
Yes.
Where did you experience the heaviest fighting in Normandy, personally?
In the area of this village called Hotto. This was this was from the enemy point of view quite an important position, because once we were, if we had got into Hotto, which we didn't for many weeks, there would have been a field of vision for some miles ahead. It was a place of some tactical or strategic importance, because as I say, from it, as I've seen since the war, you could see you could get a view of a large area of the countryside ahead. One characteristic, of course, of the Normandy blockades was that was something you couldn't do most of the time, because your field of view for observers who were acting as observation posts with the gunners and so on, or for our own mortars, the field of view was restricted to the hedge at the far side of the field you were in. But Hotto was of importance to the enemy, because from that there was good, very good observation for some considerable distance to the south, which is the direction we wanted to go in, and so they defended it very, very stoutly, and we made several attempts, or we made two major attempts to get into Hotto. Both of them we failed, and one of them was on the 11th of July. From our point of view, was very costly, in the sense that it was the after D-Day. It was second only to D-Day in terms of casualties sustained, including we had our commanding officer killed on the 11th of August in the attack on Hotto.
11th of July?
11th of July,
Why do you think it failed on the 11th of July?